We proceed with the next case, James Boyd versus Mickey Owen et al. Ms. Welsh.
Good morning, Your Honors. This case raises two legal questions. Did the plaintiff have a constitutional right here? And if so, was that constitutional right violated in a way that was clearly established at the relevant time? The answer to both these questions is no. The first question, which is whether the plaintiffs, assuming that their facts are true, as McKinney teaches, assuming that those facts are true, was there a deprivation of a liberty interest here without due process? And this breaks down into three questions. Was there a deprivation of a constitutionally protected liberty interest is the first question. And in response to that, you have to say, what happened here? Was there stigma plus? Because we know from Paul, we know from Siegert, that stigma, defamation alone, is not a constitutional violation, even if committed by, you know, if committed by a government official. And so the question is, was there stigma plus here is a question of law. And stigma plus means, was there some alteration in the plaintiff's legal status as a result of the indicated finding? And the answer to that is no. Plaintiff is not like the child care workers in Dupuy and in Doyle, is not, his status is not legally changed. Now, the Dupuy and the Doyle child care workers, their legal status is changed. If they have an indicated finding against them, they cannot work as a matter of law. And but the plaintiff, there is no similar prohibition, legal prohibition, under Illinois law against a policeman having indicated finding and continuing in his work. And indeed, we know from Maryville chief that the Maryville chief, when he told the plaintiff he had to resign or be fired, he didn't say, because I can't hire you under Illinois law. He said, because I don't want you here. So we know from the evidence and also from the law that there was no alteration in plaintiff's legal status as a result of the indicated finding. And if there was no alteration in his legal status...
Well, isn't the issue, how did the chief find out about these matters?
Well, this is the second element in plaintiff's claim. Was there public disclosure by the defendants? The testimony is that plaintiff, there's no evidence in the record, and everyone agrees about this, there's no evidence that anyone from DCFS, not just the defendants, that anyone from DCFS told the Maryville police chief. There is evidence that someone from Granite City told them. Now, the defendants cannot be held responsible for a third party making an illegal public disclosure. Now, under Illinois law, remember, both indicated findings and reports and investigations are confidential. So they could not, they were not the people who publicly disclosed this information just by making the indicated finding.
What was the indicated determination made before Boyd had an opportunity to speak with the investigators?
Well, no, I think what I'm sorry, could you re-ask your question? I want to make sure I understood it.
Yeah, I'm just wondering whether they made the determination, the indicated determination.
Well, I think the evidence
before
that...
Before he had an opportunity to speak to the investigators.
Right. I think that we have to accept the version of the facts that says they decided to indicate him before they spoke to him. But the actual indication itself, which is a formal act, you know, placed on the register and so on, that didn't occur until a month later after the investigation was ended.
Are you aware of any case that establishes that the investigators must at least speak with an alleged abuser to hear, you know, his version before determining whether abuse is indicated?
No, Your Honor, I'm not aware of any. And which, again, is the second prong of qualified immunity. There isn't any case law that would do that. But then that brings up actually the third prong, the third element that's missing here as a matter of law, which is whether there was a deprivation without due process. Now, we know from Doyle, we know from Dupuy that when you are balancing a the plaintiff's interest in future employment, which is, again, is different here from the caretakers, the child care workers, or teachers' interest, because they are automatically banned from working due to an indicated finding. So you take the plaintiff's interest here, lesser interest here, again against the state's interest in making sure that children are not abused and preventing that abuse. So the real question then becomes, what is the risk of erroneous deprivation absent more process? Well, what we know is the plaintiff got more process here. He, in fact, had an evidentiary hearing after the indicated finding. And that evidentiary hearing, with the administrative law judge, with evidence, with cross-examination, with all the things he said did not happen before the indicated finding, affirmed that indicated finding under a higher standard, a preponderance of the evidence standard, which is higher than this court said in Dupuy is needed for the initial indicated finding.
You're saying you had what, post-deprivation due process?
Yes, that's what I'm saying.
One thing I want to focus on a little bit is as far as the district court, mm-hmm. you seem to rely a lot on state law.
Correct.
On state rules and everything else, kind of saying, well, the case that was later decided may have required certain things, but he assumed then that these various state regs require them to do more, and therefore, isn't that correct?
Yes, Your Honor, that's true.
Now, do you have, in relying on only state rules, isn't there a problem with that?
Yes, Your Honor, there is, of course, because this court has said many times, and the Supreme Court has also said this, a violation of a state law is not necessarily a constitutional violation. State laws may put in more, less, you know, may have higher standards, lower standards than the Constitution, but a violation of state law, assuming that that occurred for the purposes of this appeal, a violation of state law is not tantamount to a violation of a federal law, and certainly not in this case. Remember, stigma plus, public disclosure, insufficient process when you look at the whole proceeding. Now, in Dupuy, this court didn't say just, the credible evidence standard is wrong and therefore there's a constitutional violation. They looked at the whole process and they said, okay, and remember in Dupuy what they said was, so you need to have this for these particular workers, remember, for whom an indicated finding changes their legal status, that you have to have a brief evidentiary hearing, no cross-examination, just an opportunity to be heard. That's all. And so, and here, of course, the investigator, before the formal indicated finding, the investigator did talk to Mr. Boyd, who denied that he had committed the abuse. Now, but the important thing to remember is that when you look at the big picture here, when you look at all the process that the plaintiff received, because a deprivation of a liberty interest is not unconstitutional unless there isn't sufficient process. And here we had sufficient process. And that process, the evidentiary hearing before an ALJ with cross-examination, that process led to the same result. He was indicated, and there was the indicated finding was upheld. And so here, the plaintiff, even if the plaintiff did have a liberty interest, there was stigma plus here, which there wasn't. Even if the defendants had publicly disclosed this, they didn't. Even so, even if those two things were, those first two elements had been satisfied, the third element isn't satisfied because the plaintiff got the process that he was due post-deprivation, but still he got it.
Forgive me, the indicated finding was based in large part on the child statement that Boyd was responsible. Did the investigators examine the medical records offered by her mother before crediting the child's version? I'm just trying to get a timeline.
The evidence is a little unclear about that, but I want to correct one thing. The investigators didn't rely solely on the child's statements.
I say in large part.
Right.
Free night helped. I know.
Right, but they did also, the big thing was, I think, also that the reporter said that the child's mother had told him, shown him the bruises, and said that the plaintiff was responsible for them. And also that the mother had a history of failing to protect the child from abuse by third parties. So those elements were part of the investigation. But again, even if the investigation were poorly done, were not in accordance with Illinois law, did not take into account various pieces of evidence, again, the question here is, did he receive the process that was due? And he did. He got an evidentiary hearing. He had the opportunity to present all this evidence that he says that the defendants did not take into account. And once that evidence was taken into account, the result was the same. And if that happens, if the result, the pre-deprivation and post-deprivation results are the same, there can't be a violation of due process. Now, then the question, so that legal question, the question is, the facts as asserted by the plaintiff in the light most favorable to him, do those facts allow a finding of a constitutional violation? The answer has to be no. There's no stigma plus. There's no public disclosure. There was post-deprivation hearing. So all of those things mean there wasn't a constitutional violation. Now,
but when I look at this, where the court refers to Dupuy, whatever it is, it was not raised until after this. It says the DCFS's own rules and regulations imposed a duty to identify other possible explanations of abuse. And then he goes through what they didn't do.
Correct.
But he's focused on the state regulations.
Correct. And that's the incorrect focus under a constitution.
I know we have lots of fact problems and what should have been done and whether this really was the right result, etc. But it seems to me the court has relied on state rules to come up with this constitutional violation, and I don't think that's appropriate. That's my problem. Now, I guess that's your position, but
certainly
that seems to be the focus I have a problem with. Obviously, they're going to have to address. But there are a lot of other things that are certainly troubling in this case, but that isn't where we are.
Well, no. Judge Murphy said repeatedly that the question of, of public disclosure was for the jury, right?
Well, Your Honor, that raises an interesting question because, in fact,
He did say that.
He said that at the hearing. He didn't say that in his written order. And his written order says that he dismissed the defamation claims earlier because there was no public disclosure. So there's some disconnect here in the district court's rationale. I mean, you can't just...
Well, if he was right in those statements, doesn't that mean there's a question of fact here and this thing is not appealable?
No. It might mean that there's a question of fact about causation, although there isn't a question about proximate cause. But all of these, because the plaintiff, even if there were a question of fact about cause, all of these other things mean that there is, that even if there were causation here, the fact that these other three elements aren't satisfied under any version of the facts, plaintiff's version of the facts, means that there is appellate jurisdiction and there is no constitutional violation. This is like the first three factual disputes that the district court found in McKinney. And the court said, well, if despite the district court's statement that there were those factual disputes, there would still be jurisdiction. It was just that there was this other Daubert problem that that deprived the court of appellate jurisdiction. So I see my time is almost up. Unless the court has questions, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Okay, fine.
Thank you.
Mr. Roosevelt?
If it may please the court, counsel, I think when we look at the McKinney decision of 2 weeks ago, there are parallels, or 2 days ago, there are parallels. Judge Murphy, in his order, stated there was a factual dispute regarding the issue of the loss of employment. Loss of employment as a police officer does involve a liberty interest. McKinney necessarily has said where the district court below has said there is a factual dispute present. This court on appeal in an interlocutory setting here in an immunity case is not to revisit, review, or decide that. And under Johnson and under McKinney, the idea is that factual dispute, which the district court footnote 2 describes in its order regarding that job loss. I'm sorry, go ahead.
It seems to me that what we've got to zero in on and what the question is whether the conduct of Foote and Owen violated a clearly established statutory or constitutional right of which a reasonable person would have known. And so the focus here should not be on whether all of the DCFS guidelines were followed in conducting the investigation, but on whether the procedures that were used were sufficient in light of Officer Boyd's due process rights. Now, you know, he claims that the determination that abuse was indicated violated his liberty interests by precluding his ability to be employed as a police officer. And even if we assume that he possessed such a liberty interest that would have been impacted by the finding, the determination that the two investigators lack qualified immunity seems to me to be problematic, because nowhere in the briefs or pretty much anywhere else have did I see any case law that would establish that such an investigation was unconstitutional. What he seems to have done is rely on the DCFS rules and on evidence that would have rebutted a finding. But that's not the proper focus here.
He points
out. And, you know, I'm looking for the case law here.
Judge Murphy points out that the constitutional right doesn't stem from those administrative rules. I don't think we want to forget that in the DePay case, if you look at it, the second and third page, the genesis of those rules came from U.S. District Court litigation in which DCFS was a party before Rebecca Pallmeyer, in which they came, as you describe in DePay, to a position as part of that process, which began in 01 in that litigation, to a revision of those rules. And those included a recognition that there was a duty to look at exculpatory evidence and afford some due process, afford some right to figure out, do you have the right person? But let's look at what a reasonable DCFS caseworker would have done. Would it have been obvious to them that their investigation put to risk a police officer's ability to pursue his career as they presented with a young lady on January 2 of 03? The supposed interview occurred in a police squad car on the way to the DCF office. The young lady was asked, and the record shows, what, simply, were you spanked? The answer was, from the young lady, that yes, simply was, James and Mom spanked me.
The young lady you're referring to is the 5-year-old with the disability.
Yes, thank you. And the questions were not asked as, well, which was it? Was it James? Was it Mother? The questions were not asked, where did this occur? When did this occur? Mother then presents to the caseworkers right there on the scene and says, look, this child has PTSD. This child has ADHD. This child has, you can't believe anything this child says. She has profound psychiatric difficulties and produced to the investigators those records. The investigator she was speaking to was Leslie Foote, which this record shows has a bachelor's degree in psychology, and just a month before interviewed this same child in the psychiatric unit of the Kettler Psychiatric Hospital.
Mr. Roosevelt, let me interrupt because
yes.
The child identified Boyd as the perpetrator, and the child persisted in that identification even after other names were suggested by the mother and by the investigators. The mother, of course, denies that Boyd is responsible, but she has a history of lying, and in fact, the mother had been dishonest about the existence of the bruises at all. She said, no, there are no bruises. And again, I really, need you to identify a case that would indicate that the indicated finding based on those facts is unconstitutional, or some case that would indicate that the two of the, you know, that the two investigators after this were constitutionally required to then expand the investigation. That's what, you know, that's what I'm looking for.
Well, I would say to you, McKinney tells us that we have a factual dispute here and that this case doesn't belong here. I am not agreeing that that there's evidence that the minor was clear in our identification. I'm saying the record shows in depositions that was of the investigators has shown that they didn't ask when this occurred. They did not discern whether it was mother or whether it was James. They did not discern where it occurred or why it occurred and didn't answer fundamental questions. And whether the mother, when the mother presented a medical record of a discharge from a psychiatric hospital from a month before, that's not a credibility question as to the mother. If the medical record was presented, obviously, it's a true document. Obviously, the investigator Foote testified in her deposition that she saw the child in that psychiatric unit a month before, interviewed her, and then
learned
of the
post-traumatic. Well, I mean, you could be in a psychiatric unit and know who hit you.
Okay, then let's go to a psychiatric unit on February 9th, Judge, where, again, DCFS had placed this child into protective custody. The child care family that she was placed with took the child back to the same psychiatric unit on February 9th, where the medical records introduced in before this court show the child had bruises on her buttocks, arms, legs, multiple bruises, was shown to be self-inflicting, was shown to be angry, was shown to be defiant, was shown to be vindictive, was hallucinating. DCFS, the caseworker who is involved here, Mr. Owens, approved the administration of psychotropic drugs in that hospitalization. This is during the same time period where this so-called formal investigation was going on. The testimony here is from these case agents that they made the determination on an indicated finding there at the scene on January 2 in a 15-minute drive without discerning any relevant facts.
You're maintaining that it's only the child's testimony, and yet Foote and Owens interviewed Free, Knight, Hampt, and the child before they reached their conclusion. And all of the evidence seems to indicate that Boyd was responsible except for the statements by Hampt.
None of those witnesses testified that Boyd inflicted were eyewitnesses or had any evidence to corroborate that. And aren't we to a point of McKinney where we are in disagreement on the facts? And I think the bottom line is there's a factual dispute here, and the facts need to be developed in a trial and sent back for that purpose, and then they can come back here after a trial. It's all admitted, and then we can make that determination. But that's what you said in McKinney, and I think that's where we're going. And if you look at their brief, they and their argument, they're all over the place about proximate cause and what was involved in this investigation factually, who did what, when did they do it, did they go to the hospital, did they have those records. You know, you've said in Jones versus Wilhelm that where we're looking at what an officer would do, it's what a reasonable officer would do regarding a constitutional right. What would a reasonable officer do? Now, not only what he knew, but what he reasonably should have learned, what he reasonably should have learned. Mr. Owens testified in his deposition, yes, I could have gotten those medical records. I could have obtained them from Kettler Unit. I could have reviewed them before I made my final determination, but he said he didn't. And what we have simply beyond that is our expert opining and his reports in the evidence that there was a substantial constitutional deprivation, that his opinion was that this officer can't get a job in the field. Police chief testimony is called Mr. Boyd in by Boyd's testimony in this case and said, look, I'm going to tell you something. You have an indicated finding, and you're not working here, and you are fired or you can resign. Now, that involves a deprivation of a liberty interest, and there's case law out there that a police officer certainly has a right to expect. Police officer under Illinois law has to be a person of good character. There's no doubt that background checks, and this is well briefed, are part of the process of hiring a police officer. This is a very important how we're going to handle in terms of due process. And, you know, you don't have to rely upon these state regulations to look what a reasonable person would do with confronted with these fact situations. And if you're in a car in a 15-minute drive, drive, which the testimony is of Foote and Owens. Clearly, that's when we made the decision for the indicative finding, was then and there. That's their testimony. We made that decision there, and they made it before asking any further questions about when did this abuse occur, where did it occur, why did it occur, was it mother that you're involved in, that was involved in, was it father, or was it any other number of people, including Matt Howard, who was a father, and the evidence is clear that Owens had visited in the hospital in November, 30 days before, and knew that Mr. Howard was sexually and seriously molesting and abusing this entire family. In fact, DCFS had a report on it. In fact, the caseworker knew the child suffered from PTSD. And all these facts, as Judge Murphy, were simply ignored, simply thrown out, simply disregarded. Judge Murphy says in his order, I don't find that these DCFS rules are the foundation, are the basis of this constitutional claim, but they sure mean something. They are the law in Illinois. They do spring from the DuPage litigation. They do spring because this Department of Children and Family Services was before Rebecca Palmeyer and was talking to the fact that due process is not afforded people. And that's why one of the rules says you've got to investigate exculpatory evidence. Don't you think you need to look at the fact when DCFS had this child in their custody on February 9 and were forced to take her back to a psychiatric unit with profound problems and had been in DCFS child care, had bruises all over the buttocks, all over the arms, all over the head, and was self-inflicting these wounds and had psychotropic drugs administered and was hallucinating. We have all of these profound psychiatric problems going on before and after, and the mother saying simply, look, you can't believe her. She has profound psychiatric problems. When she confronted those DCFS caseworkers on January 2, and we don't have to go there about whether this mother is believable or not. This is about a right of a police officer or any citizen to be afforded a minimum amount of due process before they make those determinations. And finally, I think McKinney is a situation where, frankly, you know, the police officer, there was a fact question, expert testimony was at issue. Ellis regarded whether or not hearsay evidence is admissible in their brief. They object to hearsay evidence. They object to our expert. They're all over the place in the brief about proximate cause, about these various issues of the facts not developed, or the facts of this, or the facts of that. And, Judge, we've talked enough about two different views of the world here today on the facts surrounding this investigation. And you're being asked, in spite of McKinney, to go ahead and charge forward and review the record and make that decision. And McKinney says that's not what we're to be doing here today, and that's what Johnson said. And Johnson told us that, look, we're not going to do it twice. Go back, try the case. The district court's ruled it may or may not come up here on appeal. If it does, you can look at all after a complete record, and I respectfully suggest
that the judge didn't rely on the DCFS rules. He just was looking at those as an indication, but did he actually disclaim that? You said something about where he said he's not relying on them.
He said they aren't the basis of the constitutional right. The constitutional right here not to be deprived of liberty interest doesn't flow from these rules that are promulgated in law in Illinois under our Illinois Administrative Code.
That's in his order?
Decision, please. I appreciate so much your time and attention to my arguments.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
Ms. Welch? Got about a minute.
Thank you, Your Honor. Regardless of what happened at the investigation, even if the investigation was constitutionally flawed, which it was not, there was, as Judge Rovner indicated, sufficient evidence to indicate this just on the investigation alone, plaintiff got the process that was due. When he raised all the things he's raising now, when he raised those at the evidentiary hearing, the result was exactly the same. He was indicated. Now, and regardless, and with regard to the McKinney issue, even if there were factual question about causation, there are three separate and independent reasons, matters of law, that are why there is no constitutional violation here. There is no stigma plus here. There's no clear alteration in plaintiff's legal status, unlike a child care worker, as a result of an indicated finding. There is no public disclosure by the defendants because all of this information is by law confidential. And, as I said earlier, plaintiff got all the process that was due, and when he got that process, the result was the same. And lastly, given the state of the law, Dupuy came out in 05, 2 years after these events occurred. There was no law on the books at the time that these events occurred that would have let any of these defendants know that there was a clear alteration in plaintiff status just because of an indicated finding, that there was public disclosure within the meaning of this of defamation, or that there was that this post deprivation process was not sufficient. For that reason, we ask the court to reverse. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Thanks to both counsel. This case will be taken under advisement.